Without further ado, let's get started with our all-women's lineup. Our first storyteller has been with us before a long time ago, and Barbara Boudreau is coming up to tell a story. I also want to remind all the storytellers in the room that Greg is our timekeeper. Before Barbara comes up, Greg, as a timekeeper, storytellers have 5 minutes, and Barbara, come on up and tell your story.
Wow, what a different view this is, huh? It's funny, I've come to all these big events here at the Cultural Center, at the Writer Center, I was going to say, at the Cultural Center, and I also do Tai Chi here every Sunday morning, and it's such a different space. When we're doing the Tai Chi, there's no sound, there are very few people, so very lovely place to do Tai Chi. Is it Deanna?
Yes.
The birthday? We have to sing, all right? Because we're in a former church. Is everybody ready? Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Diana. Happy birthday to you. Sorry, that wasn't included in my 5 minutes, was it? Oh. Okay, so I knew this was an all-women's storyteller event, but I decided to tell a story about a woman, my mother. And I'm sure that you all have heard that eventually everything becomes its opposite. Now, I Googled around on the internet today trying to find what the source of that is. If somebody can find it, please let me know. I found some referral to Socrates and all of this, but I really do think it's Asian because it follows that yin-yang thing, you know, things becoming their opposites. And I noticed the older I get that really does happen in very little ways, like when neighborhoods become gentrified into these groovy hip places that were once kind of, not slums, but what is the word that I'm looking for? Yeah. So anyway, my opposite story is about my mother. And when I was growing up, when I was especially a little girl, I have no memories of her being there. And I can't even recall, like, oh, we went there on this day. I can't even remember my mom being there. She was a mother. She was a wife. She was a secretary a lot of her life. But she didn't really ever do those, like, achievements in life that you think about, you know, like, degrees, and, you know, she never became, like, really outstanding in any field. She didn't have any hobbies. She loved to play games. Anytime you wanted to play a game, she would play. In contrast, my father was very, very educated, master's, PhD. He did exegetical teaching on the New Testament books of the Bible, spoke about 6 languages, built us a train that went around in the backyard. Built us a boat and a tractor and a playhouse. And so he was kind of larger than life, and that kind of overshadowed my mother. Anyway, I moved away when I was 18, and I never really did move back with them. And my mother got older, and my father passed away and all of that. And she had to have a hip replacement in July of 2012. And I don't know if it was the anesthetic or the surgery itself or whatever, but it pushed her right over into Alzheimer's. So I didn't know what to do. They told me she couldn't live alone anymore, and she was way out in Indiana. So I went there, and I brought her home for 5 months. She was also a wanderer, and so she kept leaving the house, and we caught her at the top of the driveway a couple of times. This was winter, and she's asking those repeat questions that just, if anybody has ever cared for one with Alzheimer's, you know what I'm talking about. Anyway, so she escaped one night in the middle of the night, and I had to go get her, and I put her back to bed, and she tried to leave the next morning, and we decided instantly we couldn't do it any longer, and she needed better care by professionals. So we took her back to Indiana and put her in an assisted living place. Now, mind you, I had only seen this place on the internet, and we walked in the door for the first time. I'm knowing that I'm going to leave my mother there tomorrow, you know, in this completely strange place. And it was beautiful. It had this sweeping staircase that went up from this beautifully decorated room with leather-bound chairs and a baby grand piano, nice dining room, all of this. But she was going into the memory unit on the third floor. So we went up the elevator with codes and everything, and when we came out of the elevator and headed down the hall, I could see all of these really old people sitting in chairs, asleep, or in wheelchairs, and I just thought, oh no, I have to leave my mother here. And she was walking down the hall. She could still walk at that time. She was walking down the hall, and she said, "This place is really nice." And the tears just jerked to my eyes because I was feeling so guilty about doing this. And even with Alzheimer's, she knew to a certain extent that something was going on, that she needed more care and constant care, right? So she lived there for 3 years. She passed away December the 1st. And I spent my first Mother's Day without my mom last Mother's Day, and it was really kind of... So I think about her constantly, and this is the part where everything becomes its opposite. When I was a child, I just thought of her as like an ordinary woman, you know, just an average kind of woman. And now that I know her much better and the person that she was before she married my dad, which is what they become with the Alzheimer's, she has become absolutely my hero because she was so brave through this punishing disease that takes their memory and eventually takes their motor skills. And that's the story of my mom. Thank you.
Thanks, Barbara. That's the story of my mom, too, in a lot of ways. So I really appreciate that from a deep place. Our next storyteller was our first storyteller in residence. It's a real pleasure to have her back. It's always a pleasure to have Virginia here, Virginia McKinney.
Hello, everybody. My story is a story about an adventure. And this happened in January of 1997. My husband and I, we went to the Western Caribbean Sea on the Costa Victoria. It was an Italian line, and it was like their second trip out, so everything was brand new and beautiful. But my husband was stricken with the flu. And the ship's Italian doctor confirmed this and said he would have to spend most of the cruise, you know, confined to his cabin. Well, we had purchased tickets to go to the turtle farm on the Grand Cayman Islands. And we sold the tickets as I was to stay on board to take care of him. So our friends all left for the turtle farm, and after an hour or so, he insisted that I, you know, try to go ashore and try to enjoy this instead of just sitting there with him all day. So I approached the captain of the tender boat to take me to shore. And when we arrived, there was a tour bus just leaving to go to the marketplace. But we had spent the day before in Jamaica. And at their marketplace, the police were there with machine guns because there's so much crime and robbery going on. And all the little shops were locked. You had to ring the bell to get into the shop. So I didn't dare go to the marketplace by myself. So I looked around and I noticed a woman that was about my age, and she was sitting on a bench, and I approached her. And in our conversation, she stated she was waiting to go to sea for an underwater adventure. She stated that her sons were scuba divers, and this cruise was a gift to her for the 50th wedding anniversary. And sadly, her husband died 2 months ago, so now she was alone. And the submarine adventure was included in their gift. So she says her sons really wanted her to experience the underwater world. Well, when I looked up, I noticed people were still in line buying tickets. And then they held out one ticket. It was the last ticket. So I ran up to to buy the ticket. It was $76, but luckily I had a credit card with me. So the woman, Lucille, she was so happy now to have a companion to enjoy this adventure. So she related to me she had been caring for her mother, but her mother died 2 days ago, and the funeral director told her not to cancel the cruise, just to go and enjoy herself, and they would take care of the funeral when she got home. So we boarded the boat, and then we were informed that the ocean was too rough to take for the submarine to dive from the usual location. So we would be taken 3 miles out to sea to a beautiful location, the Japanese Gardens. And this is where Disney Studios films their underwater scenes, and it's where Jack Cousteau's, all his films were made. When we arrived at our destination, we boarded a small submarine, and we drove 110 feet to a magical fairyland. On the submarine, there was 2 rows of seats, and it was like an egg carton, and each seat was facing a window, and each window had picture cards of names of exotic fish and beautiful vegetation, and the boat kept expelling fish food, so that the beautiful exotic fish, they came right up to our window. And we... This enchanting world of exquisite color and light and beautiful fish and sea creatures, they were all so close to us, and it was breathtaking. And we explored gigantic, magnificent, high mountain ranges that we were informed went all the way to Japan. And there were very deep valleys with no bottom. The captain was narrating the trip, explaining all we were observing, so that we didn't miss a single thing. Well, there was an Italian family sitting next to me, and they kept repeating, "Gitisi, Gitisi," which was, what is he saying, what is he saying? They didn't understand any English at all. So I started to repeat the captain's remarks in my very best broken Italian, and I was interpreting the trip to them. So after one magical hour, the submarine surfaced up to the ocean, and our boat was waiting to take us back to the Costa Victoria. And I looked at the surface, it was so flat and gray, I was overwhelmed. How could this beautiful, magical world exist under this unsuspecting ocean view? How could anyone ever doubt that our God exists to create this beautiful, this secret underwater world? I said goodbye to my new friend Lucille, and she was in awe of the Sea World adventure. I wished her well, and asked her to thank her sons, as their gift to her was also a gift to me, because I would never have had this adventure if I had not met Lucille. Sadly, I wasn't able to find her again on the cruise ship. Well, returning to the Costa Victoria, my little Italian friends greeted me, and their friends were applauding me for interpreting the captain's remarks for them, and I felt like a celebrity with all this attention. And then once I was back to my cabin, I said to my husband, "Bob, you'll never believe where I've been. I've been to paradise, and no one knew I was there." All our friends had gone to the turtle farm. And this was an awakening of a beautiful world that will remain in my memory as a blessing of the magnitude of God's love for me.
Virginia McKinnon. Love it. Love having Virginia tell a story. Our next storyteller is a new voice here. Please welcome Grace Schraft.
Well, at least Henry and Maureen and Virginia used notes, but Barbara making me sick. I mean, how did she do that? I don't know if I can. I don't think I can.
Yes, you can.
I can? Okay. All right. Well, I was trying really hard not to get scared to death while she took my mug shots and my fingerprints and gave me a body search. And I was fine until she said, "Do you have any identifying marks on your body?" I said, "What do you mean?" And she said, "Tattoos." And I laughed and said, "Of course not, because I'd never met a white person with tattoos, a woman, I mean. But I was to meet them very soon when I went to the holding cell to wait to be put in with the population. There were already two inmates in there who had just come back from their court appearances, and they seemed really very friendly and sympathetic. "Is this your first time in?" I said, "Yeah." "Are you nervous?" "Yeah." "Well, you better be, because they're going to eat you alive," she said. But that didn't happen. I didn't get eaten alive, although I did get a punch in the jaw that came out of nowhere when I wasn't expecting. But that was my third trip to jail. Because I was a mother of small kids, the DA was nice enough to let me break down my sentence, my six-month sentence, into four parts. School vacation at Christmas, school vacation at summer, school vacation at Christmas again, and then summer. And when I came back from my first Christmas vacation, when summer started, the kids were gone to Gloucester, which is where they always went anyway, so it wasn't strange for them. I noticed that some of these women were still in there. And I realized, well, some of these people have years of sentencing, you know, and how lucky I was to be able to intersperse real life on the outside with my prison time. Okay, is that 5 minutes? But I have a lot more to say, unfortunately. There were 24 of us in a room, really, seriously, no bigger than this. And we had bunk beds. So that's how they could fit us all in. if you've watched Orange is the New Black, then you've met my cellmates. And there was a convicted murderer who stabbed her victim for his cocaine. There was a developmentally disabled young woman who tried to hide her newborn in a dumpster. Didn't work. That's why they're in jail, of course. And let's see, who else? Oh, there was a very sweet woman who had a face like a down-at-the-heels boxer. You could tell that her nose had been broken many times. She was missing lots of teeth. But she finally had enough of beatings from her husband, and she stabbed him to death while he slept on the couch. Okay. They broke themselves off into racial identities, these 24 women, white, black, and Hispanic. But I wasn't that crazy about the white gang. They were pretty tough, and I did hang out with all of them because I had been a paralegal, so I became the jailhouse lawyer, and I was very lucky that way. And I made a lot of friends in there, some of whom we remained friends after our release. Okay, is it 2.5 minutes now? Here are the things I learned in jail. How to play dominoes, how to crochet, because knitting needles weren't allowed, and we couldn't eat with anything but spoons because knives and forks. Knives and forks, we had to eat with a spoon. How to use a credit card to open any door in the whole wide world for the purpose of breaking and entering. How to get away with shoplifting lots of stuff as long as you're pushing your baby in a carriage in the store. And I learned that snitching was a crime punishable by death. I learned lots of prison jargon, like creative writing meant forgery. SOS was the prison food standing for shit on a shingle. And while the men on the other side got to go out sometimes twice a day, every day, we were lucky if we went out once a week to the yard. We never saw the light of day all this time, except the one exception was they sent us out to wash the cars that are owned by the prison staff, not county, but them. That didn't last long because some of the women keyed, well, I guess you'd call it nozzled with a hose, the cars. So that was the end of that. What I learned then came as a surprise to me, what doesn't surprise me now, because I'm in the field now, that almost 100% of my fellow prisoners, whether they were in for creative writing or prostitution or shoplifting or any other kind of robbery, they were there. Either they were already high and drunk when they committed the crime, or they committed these crimes so that they could get their money for their disease of addiction. And if treatment had been an option for these women, the population would have dwindled down to a mere handful. And if I hadn't gone to jail, I wouldn't have learned what I needed to know about myself. I kept asking myself when I was in there, why me? What am I doing in here? I'm not, you know, what's my excuse? I'm white, middle class. I came from a rich family, almost rich. And I didn't suffer any of the early deprivation, well, I did, early deprivation that these women had endured, but I was voted most daring of the senior class at College High School. As a child of alcoholics, I got so used to turmoil and uncertainty that I had to have it in my life. I had to take risks all the time. That's what I learned. Thanks.
Grace, wow, thank you. Thank you, that was extraordinary. Our next storyteller is Natalie Simon. Natalie, come up and tell your story.
Tough acts to follow.
I knit. I have been knitting since I was 8 years old, and by all calculations, that's a long time. I knit everywhere, and I knit at every opportunity. I knit at theaters, I knit at board meetings, I knit in doctor's offices, waiting for my appointments, which are always late, but I don't care because I'm knitting. I knit, I travel as a knitter. I've taken knitting excursions, adventures through South America, through Asia. I've met lots of other fellow knitters who have become my dear friends. I love to knit. It's an abiding passion. Well, this story isn't just about me and knitting. This story starts back when my dad got sick. He was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer back in the summer of 2010, and after enduring and surviving an almost barbaric surgery called the Whipple, which is purported to remove the pancreatic cancer forever, well, several months later, the cancer reared itself in another organ, which meant that he needed to have chemotherapy. I took my dad to the Mass General Hospital in Boston for his chemotherapy sessions. Twice a week, once a week sometimes, a week off, every week, a month off, here or there, over the course of, just over a year or so. And the sessions were about 3 hours long, 2 hours long, sometimes four or five, depending upon what they had to do, a blood test or whatever. But I was there with my dad. And we had lots of wonderful conversations as a result, sitting there for hours on end with each other. Around that time, I started a sweater. It was a complicated sweater, a beautiful design by a Danish knitting designer. And I would bring my knitting with me because I knit. And I always have knitting with me. I have knitting with me tonight. And I will be knitting. I listen better when I knit, folks. Okay. So I would knit, and my dad and I would talk. And soon the nurses would come and say, oh, what are you knitting? Ooh, and ah, etc. And my dad was embarrassingly proud of me. He was very proud of his daughters, and he was particularly embarrassingly proud of me. So having all of his nurses flutter about me, oohing and aahing over this sweater that I was knitting each week made him very proud. And as the weeks went on, the nurses started to bring their knitting in to show me what they were knitting. And soon they were bringing their knitting problems into me. And I wouldn't get very much knitting done because I was helping them with their problems or fixing a mistake that was about 4 inches down. But I fixed it, and my dad was so proud of me. And all right, well, eventually the chemotherapy stopped working. So we stopped going in for chemotherapy sessions, and the sweater that I was knitting, which soon became named my chemotherapy sweater, got put on the pile of unfinished objects, the UFOs, of which I have many. And it lived there for what seemed like it was going to be a permanent residence because I just didn't feel like picking up that chemotherapy sweater because Dad eventually died in January of 2013. However, not long after that, my mom moved to an assisted living, a lovely place, the Cohen Florence Estates in Chelsea. And I would go visit my mom. I'd try to get in there at least once a week to see my mom. Ouch. Only 1 minute left. Oh, dear. So I would go and visit with her, and I would always bring my knitting because I knit. And on the days when we didn't go out for lunch or go out for a ride, I would sit with her and I would knit. And she would see that I was knitting something other than the chemotherapy sweater. And said, "Aren't you ever going to knit, finish that sweater? It was so beautiful." "Oh, Mama," every week it would be a different reason why I couldn't finish it, a Hanukkah present for my daughter, or "I just can't bring myself about to do it." But my mom, although the noun nag does not fit my mom, she was guilty of the verb. She did nag me a lot. Every time I would see her and I'd be knitting something else, she would ask about the sweater. One day last November, she asked about the sweater, and I said, "Mom, the next time you see me, the sweater will be done." And the next time I saw her, the sweater was done. It's this sweater.
Well, that's it.
This sweater. She died 2 weeks later. But now I wear this sweater. I think I wore it to her funeral or maybe one of the Shiva gatherings. And when I wear it, it's warm and wonderful, and I'm very proud of it. When I wear it, I feel embraced and cuddled in my parents' love and pride, but more so in having the opportunity to think about their particular characteristics. The embarrassing, nagging pride of my dad, the niggling, nagging of my mom. And I get to think about how you don't have to be perfect to be a good parent, and how you can be a loving and wonderful, beautiful parent nonetheless.
Another great one. Amazing, amazing what we had. The stories that we tell about our lives really are moving and touching. And thank you, Natalie, for that one. That was a lovely one. Our next storyteller, Karen Risterman, please come up.
It is. Isn't it amazing how, as we get older, the stories of our parents get more and more weighted? So my father grew up in the Dakotas, in the Black Hills, riding a horse. He had a dog. He had a great childhood. He ended up going to the University of Minnesota for journalism after working in a local newspaper for a while. He loved the newspaper business, as it was back in his day, back in the 1940s and 50s. He knew that he was adopted. He learned that at some point in his childhood. He had distant memories of being on a train as a child, as a young child. He had distant memories of being read to from a Norwegian Bible. So he always figured, well, we're probably Norwegian. He was adopted by a Norwegian farming family in North Dakota and grew up on a farm there, loving parents. He had distant memories of mittens, being hand-knit mittens as a child, being sent to him somehow in the mail. He always wondered about his birth family, about the circumstances of his adoption. As we can all imagine, there was a big hole in that part of his identity and personality. He never knew anything about it other than he was adopted by this loving couple who he learned later had lost a son at childbirth, and so they were very grateful to have him come into their lives, and he was a loving son to them. He had a great childhood, went on to be in the army and met my mother and got married and all of that, and always was curious and always had a hole in his identity and in his personality. And he ended up with MS later in his life and died in 1987 from MS without knowing. He always thought that he'd try to find out who his birth family was, but didn't want to do it while his adoptive mother was still alive. And by that time, he was ailing, so he never did find out. So over the years, after he passed in 87, my brothers and stepmother and I always were curious. There was a hole in our identities as well, and in our family history. We never knew anything about the things that you know about your families, medical history and so forth. We always figured we were a Norwegian, but never really knew. Ristabin was his adopted name. We knew a lot about the Ristabin family because someone in the Ristabin family did this great genealogy of the Ristabins who are still in Norway. But it never felt like ours. It wasn't really us. You know, it was like, all right, it's our family, but it's not really us. So over the years, I registered with adoption.com and started the process of trying to find out who our father's adopted family was, and ran into a whole lot of roadblocks because we're second generation. For first generation, you can pretty easily find out now who your birth family was, but a generation removed, it's a little bit more difficult. And I was going to have to go to the courthouse in Dickinson, North Dakota, where his parents were when he was adopted, and get a special dispensation from the judge there. And when am I going to get to Dickinson, North Dakota? So it just went on, and we never knew what. Anyway, so 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, overnight, an email came in to me that said in the morning, when I checked my email, possible birth family of James Francis Ristabin in the heading. And it was a long email, and it was a sort of a plea, or like a, believe me, I think we're on to you guys. And it was from a second cousin, as it turned out, making the case that we were related because they knew his birth date and his name at birth was James Francis. And we knew his birth date, and we knew that his name was James Francis. And they put it together because there were, I have a couple of second cousins who are around my age who are dogged researchers. And they, in their family, had heard stories about my father's disappearance at 4 years old in 1933. What happened to this kid? Where did he go? Nobody really knew. And it was a big hole in their genealogy that they had done. They had this whole family history of the Lovaas family, L-O-V-A-A-S, from Norway. And there was this one person missing, and it was James Francis at age 4, you know, who was born in Minneapolis. And it turned out they thought he had died. And so they started looking, well, we can't find a death certificate. They started looking at possible adoptions and found me through adoption.com and put it all together. My brother and I and sister-in-law went out to meet them in Minnesota, Minneapolis, that winter, met a lot of second cousins and great aunts and uncles. One of them, one of my great uncles, walked through the door, and he looked like my father. He had the same clothing that my father would have worn, the same hat that my father would have worn. I hadn't seen my father since he died in 1987, and this was just 2 years ago. He had the same demeanor, the same mannerisms, the same voice, and I just followed him around like a little puppy around the house. I wouldn't let him out of my sight. I was like, oh my God, don't leave me. It was a wonderful connection. So we, from my father, and out of love for him, reconnected with his birth family. And we realized over time, getting to know what the story was, that it was actually good that he didn't know. So the story that I'm telling you is really about a mother's conflict, and it's about a grandmother's deep, deep love. So what happened, his mother was unmarried when she had him in 1928. You know, she didn't have means. The man that she had him with was married to somebody else. It was just like the wrong thing to do at the time. She couldn't handle it. Her mother, my father's grandmother, brought him to an orphanage in Minneapolis where they lived, and said, you've got to find a family for him. And they did right away. He wasn't there for very long. He wasn't in the orphanage very long when they found the family. When that was the good connection. My grandmother, whose name was Karen, I'm not sure my father ever actually knew that or if it was in his consciousness, but my grandmother's name was Karen, as it turned out. For years afterwards, while he was a child, sent him every year knit mittens for Christmas. And he remembered that as part of his childhood memory. So there was a lot of love there, and it was done out of the goodness of their hearts, but I'm so glad he didn't know. I'm glad he didn't know, because it would have been too painful for him to have known, you know, about his mother, I think. But it really is about the struggles. I mean, those decisions and the struggles and the lasting love, you know, of mother, grandmother, and family, you know, just amazing, amazing connections and reconnections. So that's my story.
I'm kind of speechless tonight. I'm just in awe of everyone sharing their stories. Thank you so much and listening. The audience is so important to everyone's story. Our next storyteller, I'm really happy that she's decided to join us. Kim Lord, come up and tell your story.
Hi. My story takes place at a very backwoodsy location in the summer. First time I ever thought I was going to die, possibly be raped first. A little extreme. I was a young girl left home for the first time, and I immediately made an iced coffee, which sounds strange, but my mother was a raving alcoholic, and she made iced coffees, and at the time I didn't realize, but added a lot of vodka. So I was at the kitchen counter making a very strong iced coffee with a lot of sugar. I remember it so well, even though it was 40 plus years ago. And I remember being so excited. I'm having this iced coffee, and I know I have time because she just left, and she finally left me home alone, and until I heard a man's voice. And I thought, that's very odd. There's no man that should be here. And now, I lived in sort of country-ish, so there's no man that should have been there, at least not a delivery man in the backyard. You know, so I peeked out the window, and it was a man, and he was large and looked strange and hairy, and I remember this well as well, and I thought, well, now I'm frightened, and now I'm in trouble. So the first thing I did was dump the iced coffee. And the second thing I did was go under a bed. I remember I went under my brother's bed. I have no idea why I went under my brother's bed. But I hid, and I thought, well, hopefully he'll leave. But he didn't leave. It gets worse. So I go to the kitchen, and I look out, And lo and behold, he's dressing up like a clown. Yeah. So I'm pretty sure my parents let me watch a lot of bad movies because I instantly thought he's going to kill me like a clown. He's going to dress up like a clown, and then he's going to come in and do something really scary to me. So he really dressed up like a clown, not just like the suit, but the shoes and the makeup, and I watched it, and I kept picking up and thinking, letting this stop, and he'll go away. And I'd go back under the bed, and I came out, he's still doing it. He's still dressing up like a clown. So although I knew about 911, I thought, well, 911's not going to help me. They're going to think it's a joke. You know, I'm like 7 years old, and I'm not going to go out there. I was scared to death, you know. I was still afraid about the coffee. But I was much more afraid, of course, now about the clown. So I went back under the bed, and I waited, which seemed like an hour, but it was probably just a minute. And then I thought, oh, the phone. I'll get the phone, because there's got to be somebody I could call. Okay, so here's the next person in the story, my neighbor. His name was Hub. We called him Hub, but which I later learned his name, really was Carol. Married for 50 years, retired school teacher, drove me to school at least 3 days a week because I missed the bus. Of course, because I had an alcoholic mom, and she never got me up, and that's a whole other story for a different time. And so I thought, yes, I'll call Hub. He will save me from the clown, from the killer clown. So I go under the bed, and I'm sweating. This is hot. You know, I live in the country, and I'm sweating, and I'm scared. I'm so scared. I'm thinking, this is it. You know, this is the end. Even if I call Hub, he won't get here in time because the clown is already dressed. Okay, he's fully dressed and the makeup is on. So this is it for me. So I go under the bed, and I tried to think before I told the story how I knew his number, but I knew his number at 7. I knew his number. So clearly I called him a lot for a ride or all sorts of things. So I call Hub, and I say, Hub, I'm under my brother's bed, you know, and I'm crying, and I say, and there's a clown out back. You can imagine what he says. Oh, Kim. It's all right. And I said, no, really, there's a clown out back and no one's home and I'm scared. And he said, it's okay, I'll come right over. So again, it seemed like an hour. I was under the bed. Am I doing okay? And he comes over. And I wait and wait and I hear him. And I think, well, I gotta go out and see if the clown kills him because then I'm next. That's what I'm thinking. So I go to the kitchen, and I know it's going to seem crazy because it was 40 years ago, but I can smell the iced coffee, and I'm thinking, shit, I wish I got that iced coffee, but the clown, and now my neighbor. So I look out the window, and I happen to see the first embrace, and they're staring at each other. And then I see him start to cry, and I think, what the F? You know, I'm sure I wasn't thinking that, but what? And then I run to a different window in the house, and I see that the clown is crying. And I know I'm only 7, but I'm really like, this is like surreal and unreal, and what could be the answer? And I'm sure all of you are thinking the same thing. So the next thing that happens is they embrace, okay? And I'm not talking like, good to see you, you know? I'm talking like they hold each other, and they love each other, and they cry. Okay, I can't really remember if I thought at that time, okay, I'm saved. But I did think, this is really weird. I want my mom. And so Hub looks up. I think he realizes, oh, yes, Kim is scared, and she's inside. And he looks up, and I'm in the kitchen window, and you know, I'm on the counter at the time, and he says, it's okay, I know who this is. And for some strange reason at that age, I just accepted that. And I thought, okay, thank you. You know, and that was the end of it. Okay. So here's the thing. So he's married, I think it was 50 years. So 30 years later, I found out that Hub was a closet homosexual. And every year on his birthday, this man would dress up in a different way and come to him in a different way so his wife wouldn't know to say, I am here, come and find me, I love you.
Fantastic, fantastic. Fantastic. Wow. Our last storyteller this evening is Kathy Lorden. Kathy, come on up.
Good evening. Stage struck. I was 8 years old and I became totally stage struck. My parents had taken me to see Finian's Rainbow, and that was it. From then on, it was all musicals. So for the next 10 years, all through high school, I was into everything musical. It was like every large art group singer thing or small acting, whatever I could get into, I did. And then I went to college, and in my sophomore and junior year, I took the summers and did summer stock. And at the end of that, I took the year off from college and went to New York so I could find out what Broadway was like. After a year of that, I went back to finish college. And I decided I wanted to keep singing. I had one good opportunity back then that it turned out that I had been directed by Barry Manilow, so there was hope. There was hope here. So I had come back, and I found an agent, and he gave me this wonderful gig, the English Society Club. I thought, oh, my long dress, oh, this is going to be cool. So I offered to drive the crew to this place. So I've got my little Volkswagen Bug, and all these people, like there are three of them, but I'll tell you, it was crowded. We all crammed into my little bug, and we went driving off. And I'm sitting in the front, obviously driving, and beside me is the MC. And we're kind of chatting. And I'm listening to the ladies in the back seat, and I'm hearing the word pasties. Now, I didn't know what a pasty was. I'm a minister's daughter, naive. But after a while, I hear about the twirling and the little things and the little... I say, oh, my goodness. They're strippers. I am going to a strip club. I am not singing in a fancy English society elegant place. So I arrive, and indeed, that is exactly what it is. They're all very nice, and it worked out very well. I put my clothes on and sang. They took their clothes off and danced. And it worked out very well. I did a lot of work with strip clubs from then on. It was a good place to learn, and generally speaking, the people were really, really nice. And then my agent said, hey, listen, I've got another really good gig for you, and that is, it's a big supper club in Rhode Island. I said, okay, my long dress, I'm elegant, this is going to be cool. So I drive my little self down there, and we do the first part of the show. And the MC said, oh, by the way, at the end of the show, you've got to go back and get your money from one of the owners. I said, fine. He said, no, no, no. This is a mafia club. And one of the owners that has the money is a very lecherous man, and he likes to make contact with his people. So I said, no, I think I'm going to go home. I'm going to forget the money because I don't want to get into this. And he said, well, let me work this out. See if I can do something. I've done this club a lot, and I know these people. So at the end of the show, he said, you're okay. You can go back, and you'll get your money, and you'll be okay. All right. So I went and knocked on the door and went in, and there was Jabba the Hutt. I mean, he was lecherous, greasy, slimy, and I'm all alone in this room, and I'm saying, oh, no, this is not going to turn out well. So Jabba starts to stand up, and I'm going, and all of a sudden the door opens, and this really attractive man comes in and just stands there. He just stands there. And Jabba says, what are you doing here? He said, well, I'm here to help the young lady get her money. Jabba throws me this envelope, and I say, thank you. And I say thank you to the man as I go out the door. I find the MC and I say, what happened? He said, you know, I just told him you were a really nice kid and you had no idea that you were in this situation and that you were really going to give up all the money. And the guy said, no, no, I'll get her the money. So after that situation, I thought, you know, there's safety in numbers. So I joined a singing group. Now, I'm going to date myself. It was 1969, and I don't know if any of you know the old Gateway near Nichols Candy House. Our group sang there all summer long, and we were out there during the full moon when you came out and the water was up to your knees and everybody didn't realize their cars were going underwater. But we sang there all summer long, and it was a wonderful, wonderful place. We just had a wonderful time. So that's what brought me up here. And I've got to honestly say, I think I'm still stage struck. I still do the singing, and I probably wouldn't be standing here if there wasn't part of me that wasn't stage struck still. So thank you.
Thank you so much for coming to this show. I would like to request that the storytellers come up to the stage before you go. But thank you all for being here. It's such a pleasure to have you here so often to Fish Tales. And I have such gratitude for tonight's storytellers. I'll see you at the next show.